culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and it's particularly important in the current context of the battlefield of the culture war to stress just how great this nation is. Because the most divisive issue in America, I believe, it's certainly not just the most divisive cultural issue, it's the most divisive political issue, is how are we going to teach our children about the United States of America, about this land we live in, this land we love? Are we going to teach children to feel guilty about America's background, about America's history, about America's origins? Or are we going to make Americans feel grateful? Are we going to make our young people feel grateful? Are we going to stress gratitude? This goes back to that ridiculous idea of getting rid of Thanksgiving and making it Indigenous Peoples Day. Okay, well, now they're making Columbus Day into Indigenous Peoples Day. What exactly, by the way, are we separating on Indigenous Peoples Day? I'm not sure what that actually is. What it appears to be in places where they actually have begun celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day is basically how terrible America is, how corrupt its origins are. How can that be our original sin, our mistreatment of Native Americans, if slavery is our original sin? The entire thing, the race for attaching blame to America's origin is extraordinarily destructive and, frankly, very dangerous for our national well-being and for our own psychological health, for goodness sake. And part of what this involves is the idea of continuing the culture war. There's a powerful column today by Joe Epstein, who was a veteran of so many of these battles. And it's a column that says, no, the culture war must continue, and particularly when it comes to appreciation of America. And that means that our teachers' unions officials ought to stop lying about critical race theory. And they have a dilemma. The dilemma is that many of them believe that it's very, very important, that it's somehow noble, it's somehow helpful, it is somehow constructive to teach people that America is built on hatred and racism and exploitation and slavery, that those are the cornerstones of this amazing republic, which has actually been so shockingly good to virtually every major group, ultimately, in this population. America is not a cruel taskmaster. It's not ever been an oppressive, evil country. And the notion that you want to let people know that it is not popular. So what do you do if most of your union members teach in public schools and you believe? And again, yesterday we talked about the National Education Association, a big national teachers union that specifically is devoting resources to promoting critical race theory. That idea that everything in America is based on racism, that the country is built on racism, that our system is at its very heart racist. Okay, that's not popular, but you want to teach it anyway? So what do? Well, you lie. That's what you do. This is a speech by Randy Weingarten, who is president of the American Federation of Teachers. That's the other big teachers union other than the National Education Association. And here's what she says about critical race theory actually being taught in elementary school, middle school, or in high schools. And she says that it's clip 20, Jeremy.
Critical race theory is not taught in elementary schools or middle schools or high schools. It's a method of examination taught in law school and in college that helps analyze whether systemic racism exists, and in particular, whether it has an effect on law and public policy. But culture warriors are labeling any discussion of race, racism, or discrimination, SCRT, to try to make it toxic. They are bullying teachers and trying to stop us from teaching students accurate history.
Okay, a completely ridiculous indictment. And if you actually look at the wording, as we did a little bit yesterday, of some of the laws that have been passed by legislatures around the country, limiting the force feeding of critical race theory. Just keep in mind what you just heard Randy Weingartner saying, because she said it. Critical race theory is not being taught in elementary schools, in middle schools, or in high schools. Only in law school, she says. Well, there's a black father who stood before a school board recently and begged to differ. And it's worth listening to what he has to say, because he discusses critical race theory being taught directly at his daughter's school. This is clip 23A.
It's very apparent here by all of the parents that have spoken that this board and the school district is failing. More importantly, I came here to talk about critical race theory. This theory was never meant to be brought into grade schools, high schools, at all. It's actually taught in the collegiate atmosphere, and more importantly, the legal portion of the collegiate atmosphere, to see different laws through the lens of race, from an ethics and an ethical standpoint, right? Not for grade schools and high schoolers. The problem with bringing it to high school and grade school level is that we don't have the educators to properly teach these kids. Instead, they're using it as their own agenda to indoctrinate the kids to hate each other. And whether you believe that to be true or not, the reality is that's what's happening. Critical race theory is teaching that white people are bad. That's not true. That would teach my daughter that her mother is evil. You already have an educator within your staff that has pulled my daughter aside and said, well, you're a minority, so you know better than to engage in certain things.
Wow.
Whoa.
When I was brought to the school's attention, nothing happened to the educator. Instead, my daughter was brought in, and she was ridiculed.
Okay, obviously he's having an impact on the group to which he is speaking. And then he concludes, I think, with the sentiments from so many parents, the overwhelming majority of parents, whether they're white or black or Latino or Asian, whoever they happen to be. This is 23B.
So my question is now, with critical race theory being brought in, what is your criteria to educate the educators? And who are you to educate my children, or any of our children, in life issues? That's our job.
Yeah. Yes.
Your job is to teach them math and science. Yes. Our job is to teach them about life. I believe racial issues and tensions across the U.S. are nowhere near what they used to be decades ago. Do we have a long way to go? Sure. Do we still have individuals out there that need to be taught? Absolutely. But I believe the people here don't look at me as a black man. They look at me as a man standing in front of you, addressing the issue that we all are very passionate about.
Okay, this is happening in school boards all across the country right now. And part of what he is saying is very, very much to the point. The idea that a critical race theory would be taught or be informed a force in elementary school, it's outrageous. Where should it start? Or should it never start or proceed in any way? We will be right back with more. We'll be right back. on the Michael Medved Show, I do want to make it clear that I don't entirely agree with everything that the parent who was speaking about the critical race theory issue expressed. He basically said, it's your job to teach math and science. We'll teach children about life. I think it's also a job of education to teach people basic civics, to teach people how the government works, how it's supposed to work. And yes, there sometimes is a difference, often, between how it really works and how it's supposed to work. But at least to give people the basics so they understand what the Supreme Court is, they understand what Congress is, they understand how a voting system works, and they understand how fortunate we are to have this long-lasting constitutional republic, the longest-lasting and obviously most successful constitutional republic in history. That's worth honoring and knowing something about. But that's very different from the approach of the critters. Critters was the name when originally critical race theory turned up, starting at Harvard Law School. The people who were its advocates, like Professor Bell, were regularly referred to as critters because they were in favor of critical race theory. But the idea that you're going to teach, for instance, I have a column coming out tomorrow in Newsweek, which I think many of you will enjoy and appreciate. You can also, we'll also post it right away, link it to our website, michaelmedved.com. But the column is said, it's called, How Do You Explain the 4th of July to a 4-year-old? And I had that challenge this last 4th of July weekend, because we actually spent the day of July 4th with our grandchildren. And when you have little grandchildren who are 1 year old and 6 months old and 2 years old, they don't know what the 4th of July is. They know it's a time to be with family and it's fun, maybe. Certainly the 2-year-old does. But we also have a 4-year-old granddaughter, and she's clever. And she's curious. And we actually got into a conversation about the 4th of July. And I was very conscious of this as I was talking to her, because I explained to her about the Declaration of Independence and the difference between a government that is chosen by the people and a king who rules over people. And she knows something about bad kings because she grew up in a religious home, and she is still growing up in a religious home. And you learn about Pharaoh, who was an emphatically bad king. That's the Passover story. You learn about Antiochus, the evil king in the Hanukkah story. And King George certainly fits into that. The one thing that I found that connected most with her was what King George did that was so terrible is he ordered people to accept hostile soldiers and armed soldiers into their own homes. Even a 4-year-old can understand how miserable that would be if mommy and daddy all of a sudden had to accept some people carrying weapons who were sent by a hostile authority. And by the way, specifically mentioned in the Declaration of Independence as one of the gripes against King George was that he did that. The question I'm getting to is, at what point do you begin to tell kids about slavery? Because, of course, if you're emphasizing all men are created equal, first of all, that's a difficult concept anyway for a 4-year-old. Maybe for a 6-year-old, 7-year-old, a little bit easier. But the idea is, I made a decision not to go into the whole question of slavery, because you can't even introduce that without giving a complete history. To talk about the idea that we had some founders who owned people, which is a profound evil, who were like Pharaoh in that regard, is not a complete story until you get into the fact that at the very same time that they were fighting for the revolution, the anti-slavery movement had already started. The two most populous northern colonies, Pennsylvania and New York, both had abolished slavery by the end of the Revolutionary War. They both did it in 1780, and you can look it up. But in any event, the point about this is that the idea of teaching critical race theory, for goodness sake, in the in elementary school or preschool is just outrageous, and it's inappropriate because you can't even get into any depth about any of the issues. And are there issues? There are. The deeper issue is one of the culture war. Joseph Epstein, who is a veteran editor, writer, social commentator, he's somebody who's been a distinguished commentator on our civilization for a long time. He writes a column today in the Wall Street Journal under the heading, "The Culture War Must Go On." And he talks about a conversation he got in with the late Irving Kristol, who was one of the real originators of leading a group of one-time liberals, even democratic socialists, into the Reagan coalition. And he was honored by President Reagan. And in any event, Irving Kristol, who a frequent contributor to Wall Street Journal, by the way, he ran into a conversation with Joseph Epstein in 1996. And he said, the culture war is over. And then he paused and added, "We lost." Okay, who is we? Who lost in the culture war? And that's what he writes about, and how we can't give up and we can't lose. The extent of the culture war, well, that's something else. And we will talk a little bit more about that. Part of the mistakes in the culture war end up bringing up another American crisis, which is written about in National Review in a fine article. The headline, "American Men Suffer a Friendship Recession." Is that happening? And especially now that we are making progress, thanks to the vaccines, against the pandemic. Why is that happening, and why does it matter? We'll speak to Daniel Cox of National Review coming up on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
Michael Medved's marvelous.
On the Michael Medved Show, with all of the concerns about rising crime and rising inflation, maybe we don't even have the room, the mental space, to feel any concern about surging disconnection. Actually, that's a phrase in a new piece in National Review. It's a very thought-provoking piece and a very important one by Daniel Cox. He is the founder and director of the Survey Center on American Life and a senior research fellow at American Enterprise Institute. His new piece in National Review is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Its headline is "American Men Suffer a Friendship Recession." And Daniel, first off, people are going to say, well, of course we have a friendship recession because all of the things you normally do with friends, barbecues and going out to sporting events and dinners out, all of those things were suspended during the pandemic. But this surge of disconnection that you write about, this actually goes back long before the beginnings of COVID-19, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it's not just a reaction to being isolated and separated from our friends, unable to hang out. It's a more systemic, long-term change and decline that we're seeing in American friendships, one that has been a precipitous decline for men.
Well, one of the numbers that just sticks in your mind, and it's tough to get it out of your mind, is between 1990, according to your survey, and today, the percentage of American men with at least six close friends fell by half. It's now only a quarter of American men say that we have at least six close friends. And this is the stunner, is the percentage of men without any close friends at all. Guys say, no, I don't have any close friends. It's now 15%, and it jumped all the way in the last 30 years from 3%. Why that huge increase?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here, and I think there's a lot to be disturbed by in this report. And to let your listeners know what we did, there's not a lot of survey work done about friendship. It's not a topic that gets researched all that often in this way. And what we did is we replicated a Gallup survey from 1990. So the 1990 data we look at is from Gallup, and when we asked the identical questions, to trace, you know, from then to now, what, you know, where do we end up? And so that allows us to look at these really, really, and identify these really, really sharp declines. And so that's really one among many interesting findings in this. We saw a significant decline among people who have best friends too. And there's a lot going on. What I state in the piece is that, you know, we're seeing a delay in marriage. So, you know, a generation ago, people were getting married much younger. We're seeing a decline in religious attendance and people connected to religious communities. We're seeing, you know, changes in the way people work. People change jobs more often. They have, you know, maybe multiple jobs before they turn 30. And people are working longer hours, and it creates more obstacles to developing long-term healthy friendships.
What about the whole problem of screens, of people relying on social media? Has that been a saving grace for friendships, or do you think that that's generally had a negative impact?
Yeah, I think the verdict is still out on that one. There's some people that say that, you know, they're very different, right? The way that you interact with people online. And so I don't think it's a substitute, but I think it can, you know, if you play video games with your friends online, if you are members of, you know, online chat group and you connect there, or if you meet people online, that's great too. But I think, you know, one of the things we're seeing is that men compared to women face more difficulty, you know, developing sort of emotional connections. So they are less likely to rely on their friends for emotional support. And I think that's a lot more difficult to do online. I think a lot of that requires some, you know, some personal interaction, you know, interpersonal interaction that is offline. And so I think that's a big issue.
And then again, there's so much of the time that people spend online is not interacting with anybody, really just interacting with binge-watching on Netflix, or basically the hours that are now devoted toward watching forms of entertainment, you can't really develop tight friendships if you're watching at home and watching miniseries that will go on for 10, 15 episodes. That's not a substitute for getting together regularly with people who mean something to you. Why is it important? Why should we even be concerned about this surge of disconnection?
Oh, for any number of reasons. It's linked to all these, having many friends linked to all these really positive mental health, physical health We know that one of the biggest killers, actually, for people in who are older, is loneliness. It can physically kill you. In fact, there's a famous study that looked at and compared being alone for a certain amount of period of time to smoking cigarettes. Like, they found similar adverse health outcomes based on those two conditions that were roughly comparable. And so we know this really matters for people's personal health. It also matters civically and politically. You know, when we're engaged with each other, when we're involved in our communities, when we're connected to each other, it just allows us to sort of broaden our horizons, broaden our experiences, make friends across lines of race and ethnicity and politics in ways that are really beneficial for society.
In your piece, you raise some interesting discussions about why it is that women have a less acute problem in this regard. Women, and as you put it, they put in the work. I mean, I know my wife and I are very different. My wife speaks on the phone or in person with her close friends all the time. And men tend not to. Now, it used to be that would be because men had work to do, they had formal jobs. Women work now, too. So why this difference between men and women, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think some part of it is cultural in the way that men are socialized, that picking up the phone and just chatting with, you know, your male friend is not something that men are socialized to do. It's more activity-based. Like, let's go, let's go to a movie. Let's go play some pickup basketball. Like, let's do those types of activities. And in the course of doing those, we may talk about our day, or, you know, the health of our parents or how our kids doing or problems with our spouse. But I think we don't see that behavior, at least in our data, and I think in other data as well, that, you know, texting regularly or sending a note, just how you doing, is not something that men do, but it's something that they absolutely could do. And one of the things I mentioned is that, yeah, women are putting in the time. And men say, and a lot of men say this, I have this experience myself, where men say, well, you know, I could, you know, I haven't talked to my friend for 3 years, but I could pick up the phone and call, and we'd be right back where we were. Well, the problem is, in those intervening 3 years, you're not gaining the benefit of regular association, regularly chatting with this person. You're denying yourself that. So even if the friendship isn't suffering, like, you aren't getting the same benefit.
And people should not deny themselves the benefit of some enlightenment in the piece, American Men Suffer a Friendship Recession. A great job by Daniel Cox. Check it out at Michael Medved. Michael Medved show, the culture war, as it's called, actually connects very directly to what we're just talking about, which is the friendship recession, Daniel Cox calls it. And it's very important to consider, because the loneliness of American people, as he put it, has real health consequences, not just mental health consequences, but physical health consequences, and can be deeply serious. And it relates to another profound cultural issue, which has been at the center of the so-called culture war in America for 40 years. Just about, really, it's that long. I'm talking about marriage and the idea that right now, by every measure, of course, marriage is still the dominant institution in the society. Nearly everybody gets married at one time or another. It's over 80% of people get married at one time or another. And most of those people who get married do not get divorced. It is a complete fiction, and has been for years, that half of all marriages end in divorce. That simply is not true. And it is much less. It is still a lot of people, millions and millions of Americans. The culture war about marriage or concerning marriage, it goes back to, do you remember when Dan Quayle, he was vice president of the United States, and he made a speech and he was critical of the TV show Murphy Brown because it showed this very glamorous newscaster, journalist, television journalist, played by Candace Bergen. And Murphy Brown got pregnant out of wedlock and had the baby. And I think Dan Quayle made a very strong point. You can go back and read the speech, and the speech actually sounds prophetic, where he talked about the economic problems, the educational problems, all the other problems that children have when they grow up with just one parent. Doesn't mean that single parents are evil. Far from it. There are single parents who do a magnificent job and make lots of sacrifices and actually show exemplary care and concern and insight and devotion in terms of raising their children with good values. However, it is clearly a very, very big sign about marriage changing, not dying, but changing in a very dramatic way, and I don't think in a positive way, when you have, as you have today, 40% of new babies, 40% of new babies in America, of all ethnic groups, of every composite, are born out of wedlock. That's an indication of what Joseph Epstein was talking about in his conversation with Irving Kristol back in 1996, where Kristol said the culture war is over, we lost. Because if you take a look at a lot of those issues that were culture war issues 20, 30, 40 years ago, one of the big culture war issues in the latter stages of what people call the culture wars was gay marriage. That's settled. And right now, overwhelmingly supported by the American people, one of the other culture war issues was recreational drugs. And certainly that emerged as a big issue in the 1960s. Now, in terms of public opinion, there is overwhelming support for legalized marijuana. Legalization and legal status and support for gay marriage is one of those other issues. And I think that there are a lot of people on the right who look at this current issue about what we teach our children, about teaching patriotism, about trying to encourage guilt rather than gratitude for our children and what we teach about American history and American institutions. I do believe that a lot of people have a sense that this is a different kind of cultural issue. And it's one we simply cannot afford to lose or to give up. Because, frankly, the impact on a country of basically not learning its history accurately, which is, I think, exactly what's involved here, is profound. America is not just like other countries. And in fact, there are a lot of people on the left who say, no, America is not just like other countries. America's worse. Just think for a moment. We just went through our big national holiday, July 4th, our birthday of America. I was talking before about how do you speak to a four-year-old about 4th of July? Well, it's America's birthday. Four-year-olds, even two-year-olds understand birthdays. That's something they get, so you celebrate. But the idea that we have coming up on July 14th is Bastille Day. It's the big French national holiday. And, of course, they make a big deal of it in France, and, well, they should. They celebrate their revolution. How'd their revolution work out? There were at least 25,000 civilians who were executed for political crimes in the French Revolution. It was bloody, it was horrible, and it didn't lead to permanent democratic institutions. It led to a dictator who later became an emperor named Napoleon Bonaparte, and a devastating shedding of blood throughout Europe that really was about nothing. And in the United States, we had a revolution that didn't have perfect results, but it produced the establishment of a new regime that went much further and ultimately went the full distance regarding slavery and abolishing slavery than they ever did in France. They reestablished, Bonaparte reestablished slavery in 1802 at precisely the time that American states were getting rid of it. And this context, Joseph Epstein writes, he says, although the culture war would appear to be over, to surrender to the dreariness of woke culture, which tramples on art, is without intellectual authority, allows no humor, and is vindictive toward those who oppose it, is unthinkable. So praise the Lord and pass the ammunition. It's back to the trenches, for there isn't any choice. The culture war must continue. And that's particularly in regard to the issue of the teaching of our history. And that history is extraordinarily important because the alternative is, well, the alternative is you could hear it on Joy Reid's show. This is clip 10, where she had on Ta-Nehisi Coates and Nicole Hannah-Jones, and she basically mocked white people in general. This is clip 10.
You have written, you know, so searingly about the theft that has undergirded American society, right? The plunder, as you've put it. And I think part of that has been psychic. It, right? It has been for so long accepting the bland narrative that lionized these founders as sort of a bedtime story rather than confront the real pain that's in the history that built us to be strong as we are. Do you think that this chapter teaches the people at UNC anything about the ramifications, the consequences of that plunder? Or do you think they say, good, two less problematic black people that are going to tell our poor white students who are so fragile that they can't handle the truth, they won't tell them that now.
So poor white people who are so fragile they can't handle the truth. It's outrageous. And yes, it is a debate and a dispute that needs to go on. Is the argument over vaccines part of a culture war? And if so, based on which culture and how? We will get to that and to much more, including a nation where it's really, really hard to even survive as an athlete. That and more coming up in this greatest nation on God's green earth.